Okay, we are going to get started here. I open up the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. And today is March 27th, and I'm going to just let you know we're first going to do the work session on Senate Bill 536. So I'm going to go ahead and open up the work session on Senate Bill 536. Beth, if you can remind us what this bill does, and then we have Art James is going to come up and talk us through the amendment.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 536, there's a proposed -2 amendment in front of you that's been developed since you originally heard the bill on the 20th of February. It authorizes a state agency by rule to implement a program to locate on the premise of the agency a device or facilities that installs or has installed specifically to deliver electricity to public for motor vehicles that use electricity for propulsion.
Okay, great. So, Mr. James, do you want to come up? Can talk to us a little bit about this amendment and let us know what exactly it's going to do as far as for folks who want to be able to plug their vehicles in the state building, making sure that the citizens of Oregon are not picking up the tab. So thank you for being here today.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art James. I work for the Office of Innovative Partnerships with the Oregon Department of Transportation. And ODOT has been involved the last couple of years. We've received some federal grant money to put in charging stations for electric vehicles around the state. And I submitted a brochure that has a map showing where charging stations have been installed with ODOT funds. One of the reasons why we developed Senate Bill 536, and I was working with a small working group that included the governor's office and the Department of Energy, was because we didn't have specific authority to install these equipment at state facilities. And consequently, there is now in the state of Oregon probably about 600 or 700 charging stations that have been installed, many of them at local government facilities, cities, counties, school districts, other places like that, but none at state facilities because we just didn't have authority for that. So it's a fairly simple bill. It allows agencies to contract with providers to put in charging facilities as long as it doesn't subsidize the private entity or charge more than what the cost of making that available is. And that's in the section. So to the amendment, the -2 amendment, when we first got the legislative fiscal statement from the fiscal office, their assumption was that if, since the language is permissive, it allows agencies to install charging infrastructure, that all agencies would do it kind of to the maximum extent. So their fiscal impact was very large. If you assume that every agency that has a facility anywhere in the state is going to install charging infrastructure, that could have a very large impact. So the -2 amendments essentially put some sideboards on that, say that an agency in any given biennium would install no more than 5 charging stations. Other than the Department of Administrative Services, since DAS actually controls a lot of state facilities, they would be able to install up to 10 charging facilities within a biennium. So that brings down the impact substantially. The only exception to that in subsection C of section 2 of the amendment, it says that if these are being funded with grant funds, those sideboards would come off. And there is a good potential that there will be additional federal money available for expanding the charging network in the future. And if it's at no cost to the state, we would suggest that those limitations would come off. So that's really the gist of the amendment. And I'm sorry that I wasn't here for the public hearing, but I would be happy to answer any questions about the bill or the amendment.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate you working with our committee staff to make sure that we got the amendment correct and for clarifying some of the questions that we had. Are there any questions for Mr. James? Yeah, Senator Olson.
Mr. James, in the amendment, the -2 amendment dated 3/19/13, on the last page, or page 2, I should say, line 6, it says substantially exceed. How do we define substantially exceed?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the in total, that says that the state agency shall not set the price at a level that does not substantially exceed the cost to the state agency of making that electricity available. So the cost of making that available would include the cost of the equipment, the cost of the installation, amortized over the useful life of that that station, as well as the actual electricity. So in pricing that, we want to make sure that the agencies aren't making too much money on it, but also that they're able to recoup their cost and not having it be a cost on the budget.
Pardon me, sir. I think you must have misunderstood me. I was looking for the definition of substantially exceed.
Oh,
line 6 on page 2.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that's not defined in the bill, so it would be a de minimis amount that would be allowable, and it would that anything more than that, I guess, would be considered substantial.
Follow up. I apologize for putting you on the spot on that one. It just concerns me when bills come out without definitions. Will each state agency, will they be able to charge their own rate, or will there be one set rate for the entire state?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the rates actually vary. Currently, as I said, there are some 700 charging stations around the state. Different vendors charge different amounts for that. And it's similar in many cases to like a cell phone plan, where you might pay a monthly membership to be part of the one vendor's network, and then you pay so much for minutes connected after that. And because there are different firms in this space and they're competing with each other, the rates do vary.
One follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Those vendors that you mentioned, does the consumer, the state employee that plugs his car in, does he pay directly to the vendor, or is it taken from his paycheck, or does the state agency pay the charge?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, it's to the vendor that installs the equipment.
From the employee?
Right.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for those excellent questions. Any other questions? We are in a work session, but I want to make sure, since this amendment is a new amendment, that we got all our questions answered before we have a motion. So seeing no other questions, I will take a motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 536, dated 3/19/13.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 536. Is there any discussion? Okay. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Take another motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move that Senate Bill 536 be reported out of committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Senator Olson moves that Senate Bill 536 be reported out of committee with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Hanson?
Aye.
Senator House?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Aye. With that, the motion passes. Is there any volunteers to carry the bill?
Anybody done?
Okay. Great. Senator Olson will carry that. We'll carry Senate Bill 536 with the dash twos. With that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 536. Okay. And then also, my staff is letting me know that Senate Bill 692, which is listed on the agenda, we will be carrying over that work session because we are still waiting for the amendments on that. And hopefully, we'll have that by April 1st, on April Fool's Day. Okay, with that, then we'll move to our public hearing for the day, which is I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 523. And Beth, if you can read the bill for us and let us know what's up.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 523 requires water quality permit holders who discharge persistent bioaccumulative toxins into Oregon waters at concentrations that cause waters to fail to meet water quality standards to pay for installation and maintenance of marker systems. Declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Two sessions ago. All right, thank you. Oops, sorry. I should put my phone away. It's ringing. With that, yes, Senator House was calling me and wants to know
what's going on.
Yeah. Okay, first we're going to have the Department of Environmental Quality up to provide an overview So for some of, I guess Senator Hass is the more senior member of this committee. We had a bill up two sessions ago, Senate Bill 737, is that correct? That, it was 737, wasn't it?
That's correct, 2007.
Yeah, it's amazing, I can still remember numbers. And we, so we had quite a bit of discussions in the committee about mixing zones. And I think one of the things that I was very interested for the department to do was come in and provide us with background for the for all the committee members on what mixing zones are, what they do, why we have them, and a little bit of background on Senate Bill 737. And I think we're going to hear a little bit more about that today. So thank you, gentlemen. So whoever wants
Madam
to go
Chair,
first.
Yep. Nope. Madam, just as a point of history, in 2001, I feel like we just stepped out of that meeting and right back into it again in 2013.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I was on the committee then.
In the House.
In
I
the
think
House.
You were on that
Same
committee, too.
Same exact thing. And I, this is still going on. I mean, you know, not the mixing zones, but the fact that we're talking about what kind of buoys to put in, how to market,
right.
What's like the summer, what's like. Do you want me to come up and give the lecture?
That's right. Three of us were here in 2001. We're giving our age away, but. All right, gentlemen, thank you. Well, there will be a quiz to see how much you've remembered,
what's
Senator.
I want to remember.
So good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and committee members. My name is Greg Aldrich. I'm the Water Quality Division Administrator at the Department of Environmental Quality. And with me is Dennis Aides, manager of the Surface Water Management Section. So as the chair said, I'm here to provide an overview about what is a mixing zone, what is the history of the issue, and then how it actually turned into Senate Bill 737 back in 2007 and where we are today. So to begin with, here is an aerial view of a mixing zone. And the mixing zone is an area where a discharge undergoes initial dilution and mixing. So when you look at this photo, and I have to tell you, we're not even sure this photo is from Oregon or from when, but when you see the white plume going along parallel to the shore coming towards us, that is the mixing zone, and this is just for illustrative purposes. This obviously is mixing zones as a place pertains to water. I also want to remind people that we have a similar thing in air quality. Often it's called dispersion. So often what comes out at the end of a smokestack up in the air also doesn't meet the ambient air quality standards that we would all breathe on the ground. And the same thing is true for our cars. When you think of the tailpipe and what comes out of our own cars, what comes out at the point of the tailpipe is not what we measure for ambient ambient air quality standards. So here is a diagram to try to illustrate mixing zone, what we call regulatory mixing zone. So what you see is a stream in blue moving to the right. You see a dark fixture on the left-hand side, and that is the outfall pipe coming from, let's say, an industrial source, but it could be a municipality wastewater treatment plant. And then it is discharging into the river, and as the current is coming by, it is capturing the discharge and creating a plume. And in that discharge area is where you see the regulatory mixing zone, both the length and the width is defined in this diagram. For wastewater permits, EPA allows states to adopt their own mixing zone regulations as part of the state water quality standards. And to remind you, standards are approved by EPA. A regulatory mixing zone is an area defined in permit where a discharge undergoes initial dilution and mixing in the receiving stream, and water quality criteria are suspended or lessened provided several conditions are met. Within this zone of the mixing zone, water quality standards may be exceeded as long as it's not lethal to organisms passing through the mixing zone and all the beneficial uses of the water body, such as drinking water, fish habitat, recreation, or other uses, are protected. DEQ calculates mixing zones to be as small as feasible. Size varies based on how concentrated the wastewater discharge is, the size or flow of the water body, includes design for low flow conditions. At any flow higher than that, the water quality will be better than what the permit allows. So think of, we're really designing for late summer. Also consider the we consider the location of the discharge in relationship to the critical habitat, such as salmon spawning areas, drinking water intakes downriver, recreational areas. Again, I said we try to make them as short as possible. We tend to have them in the 5 to 300 foot range. Most of them are typically 100 foot. Maybe one other thing I'd want to point out is DEQ regulations do not allow discharge of toxic pollutants in concentrations that would be dangerous for people and wildlife if they swim or float through the mixing zone. So we do not allow a mixing zone for bacteria, and often people think about bacteria as the main thing when for water contact recreation. So again, there are no mixing zones. That needs to be treated to meet the water quality standard at the end of the pipe. There are about 300 active permits with mixing zones in the state. Some of these are for things like temperature or turbidity, and others could, that would not have any impact on human health, while others could directly impact human health. Most or permits include monitoring requirements to ensure that discharge is in compliance with the authorized mixing zone. So any questions about mixing zones, very specifically, otherwise I'll sort of go into the history. Back basically in the mid-2000s, there was a lot of controversy from the public and from people in the legislature about mixing zones. And in 2005, several bills were introduced to ban, study, or mark mixing zones. None of those passed, though a couple of them came from the Senate and one came from the House. What did come out, though, is in 2006, there was a mixing zone workshop that was conducted in conjunction with the OSU Institute of Natural Resources. And the purpose of that was really to get into issues about what do we know about mixing zones, what is unknown, and what are the major concerns about mixing zones. This one-day workshop really provided a great exchange of information for all those who participated, and being there, I remember, it had a very large turnout, including legislators being there. But what was quick to come to fruition was that it wasn't just mixing zones that were concerned. There was a lot of concerns about toxic pollutants and how are we addressing toxic pollutants in this state or across the nation. And what was clear is that we knew very little about the types and concentrations of toxics in waterways, and we knew little about the amounts and effects of what was being discharged into the waterways. And I think at the same time, this mirrors what was going on for air quality, for what's in our food, for other consumer products. People are just concerned about toxics, and that concern is growing and growing. The workshop led to a couple of things that took shape in the 2007 session. First of all, we put together a toxics statewide monitoring program, something we put together with stakeholders and vetted with a lot of different interested parties, brought it to the legislature, and it was fully funded back in 2007. Lots of support for that. There was ongoing effort to characterize the presence and concentration of chemicals of concern in Oregon's environment. That's what we're really trying to do through this program. We're working on a basin rotation approach, which means DEQ will look at certain basins every year, and every 5 years we'll have gone through the whole state. We will complete the first cycle at the end of this year, and we hope to have summary data out on this effort within the next 2 years. So after we finish collecting data and analyzing it this year, pulling together in 2014. The other thing to remember is this monitoring program has been reduced in scope due to the state budget cuts that occurred in 2009 and in 2011. So what we started out with, our goals in 2007 have been pared back, but we have tried to be very diligent and rebalance our work in the scope to make sure we have an effective effort and that we'll have some good information to report statewide after this year. So in 2007 came Senate Bill 737, and that directed DEQ to compile a prioritized list of persistent pollutants known as the P3 list to guide Oregon's pollution prevention efforts. And persistent in this case means persists in the environment or accumulates in animals. We were to submit the list to the legislature by June of 2009, and then report on sources and pathways of those pollutions back in June 2010. And of course, we did those things and presented them to this body. At that time, 117 persistent pollutants were put on the list. 49 of those are legacy pollutants, and about 40% of them currently have water quality standards. The 737 program required Oregon's 52 largest municipal wastewater treatment plants to develop plans to reduce the presence of persistent pollutants detected in their effluent above water quality standards or in their discharge. This was to help us understand what was in the effluent and then led to an extensive examination of persistent toxics in the wastewater treatment facility effluent. Oregon was the first state to take on a study like this, and of course that effort was paid by a surcharge on permit fees. So what did we learn? Pollution reduction measures in place are working to keep the majority of the P3 pollutants out of wastewater. Most of these pollutants were not detected at measurable limits, and only 5 occurred above the threshold levels that were set by DEQ. And 5 municipalities, as a result, have developed pollutant reduction plans for one pollutant, 2 of them for arsenic, which is a naturally occurring metal, and that was for the Klamath Falls in Ontario. 2 was for a plant-based sterol for Oak Ridge in Clackamas County in Hermiston, and 1 is for pyrene, which is a PAH associated with combustion, which is with the City of Portland's Columbia Boulevard plant. All communities have developed their plans are required to submit annual reports. So what is the result of all this effort? We've really advanced our efforts in science with regards to toxics and wastewater discharges. Toxics criteria are getting more and more stringent over time. We are requiring facilities to monitor for more toxics using lower detection limits. We have better tools for evaluating the potential for detected pollutants that could be harmful in the environment. And we have a heightened focus on pollution prevention, looking upstream for ways to remove toxics from the wastewater stream before it gets into the river. And I know you'll be hearing more about that in a few minutes. We have to remember that the Clean Water Act was written in the 1970s and really had a focus on pollutants that were of concern at that point in time. I think it's safe to say that DEQ's efforts and actually the efforts of this body in terms of looking at pollution prevention efforts and our efforts with the permittees and other interested stakeholders in the public have really tried to move us into the future, looking at what are the emerging pollutants, what are the emerging toxics of concern that we need to start addressing now to make sure they don't become the problems like PCB or DDT in the future. The other thing I want to tie in is that the work we've been discussing is one piece of a broader effort to identify and reduce toxic pollutants in the environment. And this is DEQ's toxics reduction strategy. This is meant to be a comprehensive air, land, and water approach. And it's to gather better information on toxics in the environment, supporting statewide and national efforts to develop less toxic alternatives for products that we use daily, how we work with businesses that use and dispose of toxic chemicals to streamline their processes and replace materials with less toxic alternatives when possible, and educating homeowners, you and me, on how to reduce the use of and properly dispose of hazardous waste. Because if we don't dispose of it properly, it will often end up in the waterway. And obviously to maintain our ongoing efforts to clean up legacy pollutants from past practices, and that's something we'll be working on for many, many more decades.
Can you just explain, make sure everybody understands mm-hmm. what legacy pollutants are?
Legacy pollutants would be things that are currently not in common use or not allowed to be used at all today. So DDT is a very good example, heavily used back into the 70s and is no longer allowed to be used in this country, but there are concentrations of it either because it's been in the soil or in other places across the state that eventually through stormwater or other runoff could end up in the, or does end up in the water. Okay. That's one of the more common ones.
Sure. Okay. I just asked that. You're taking questions now, or do you want to say a few words?
Not this time. I'll be available for questions.
Okay. Okay. Great. Okay. Any questions on the presentation? Yep. Senator Hansel.
My question is, do the what the Bill 737 implemented, is the program working from your point of view? I mean, is it meeting the needs that are addressing the problem?
So Chair Dingfelder and Senator Hansel, our response would be, yes, it is. We went in not really knowing what was out there. We did a lot of sampling and analysis, and we We know that there are things have been found, but they haven't exceeded the thresholds except for those five cases. But I think it's really driven the state, particularly the municipal governments, to think about, okay, how do we minimize what's going in the water so we don't have to treat it or do extra things to take it out through the treatment process. So I think it is a success. And it certainly provided us a lot of information to help us grow where we need to go for toxics, controlling toxics in the state.
Follow-up, do we need any more legislation to make the program successful?
Senator, 4737, no. It's an ongoing program, though right now there's only five that are actively involved in it.
Five?
Five communities. They have ongoing plans because they went over the threshold.
Other questions? Senator Bates.
Well, just real quick. You're going to have a report in a year, you said? Did I hear that correctly? In the first part of your discussion, about a year or two, you're going to have a report on the state?
Chair Dingfellow, Senator Bates, yes. On the overall look at the toxics picture across the state, yes. There would be it would be our goal probably later in 2014 to have a statewide report out there. And, of course, we would be glad to come share here with that.
Follow-up?
Follow-up, yeah.
At this point, have you had anything in your data that gives you pause, anything you're concerned about, or are things rolling out kind of like you thought they would?
Can I answer that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, can you bring the mic close to your, and please identify
Chair
yourself.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates, I'm Dennis Aides with the DEQ Surface Water Management Section. It's in the permitting program at DEQ. Earlier in my career at DEQ, I was the manager of the Toxics Monitoring Program. And recently, we did post some information from our initial efforts on the Willamette River Basin assessment work that was launched not long after the 2007 legislative session. Double check to see if that information is still available. Some of the things that we did find are the usual legacy pollutants of concern, you know, the PCBs and the DDTs and things that we're all pretty familiar with. Brominated flame retardants are something that we find quite frequently. These are the flame retardants that have been in fabrics around, and we find elevated levels of that in fish tissue as well. We did look for chemicals of emerging concern, pharmaceuticals and so on, and if you look for it, at low enough levels, you do find these things. So the products that we consume do pass through and end up in the waste stream.
And I guess a follow-up to Senator Bates' question, do we know what the impacts, even at low levels, to these chemicals are, especially to fish? Because that's, you know, we promote the Willamette River as a vibrant fishery, and I'm assuming you're doing sampling on fish tissue as well, continuing to do that.
Chair Dingfelder, that's correct. We do collect fish, although not all of these chemicals will be recoverable in fish tissue. They may, unlike the legacy pollutants, which do tend to accumulate in fat or tissue, a lot of these do not stick around, basically, in the tissue to exert their influence. Some of the pharmaceutical chemicals, are endocrine disruptors. They can have effects on fish. There is quite a bit of information to that in the literature as far as estrogens and things of that nature.
Any other questions for the department? Yes,
Hansel.
Senator.
When was the most recent plume that we've had here?
I'm sorry, okay. Senator Olson.
Have we had a plume recently in the rivers? You discussed plumes, and we have pictures of plumes. Have we had a toxic plume in the river recently?
Senator Dingfelder, or Vice Chair Olson, that wasn't meant to be I was just trying to illustrate what a mixing zone looks like, and that was a visual example of a toxic plume.
Right. Have we had a plume or a mixing zone event recently, or do we have them currently?
Senator Olson, we have over 200 current facilities with mixing zones, some of which may be visible because of elevated levels of turbidity or something like that. Again, the defined regulatory mixing zone is generally 100 feet or less. But certainly, from an aerial perspective, you may be able to see some of these plumes.
What what would be the mixing zone in downtown Portland? In Portland Harbor, is there? How many numbers are there down there? Too many to count?
Well, Senator, we'd have to get you that information. I couldn't tell you how many active discharges with mixing zones there would be in that area.
Okay.
And we'd be glad to do that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Other questions? Senator Bates.
Yeah, it just triggered a thought. I'm kind of going back over all this stuff. Mixing zones are allowed and regulated, and as long as it meets regulations, the regulations are based on usually pretty sound science, so they're okay. In times of low water, it could be a problem, or a plant having trouble with its discharge because of some malfunctional plant. Those are issues that can occur. It's my memory again, but I remember one of the other issues we had at that time was actually runoff from cities, especially during times of flooding. And there was a huge cost to trying to deal with that, but some of the bigger cities, including Portland, were trying to deal with it at that time and really putting some significant financial reserves into this. Where is that at this point? That was 10 years ago now.
Yeah, right. Chair Dingefelder, Senator Bates, so what you're probably referring to is the CSO project in the city of Portland, or the big pipe project, and that project was completed a year ago. The major milestones, and then totally completed, I believe, the very beginning of this year, and they've celebrated completion of that. So there were several other cities that went through a similar repiping, if you could say that, to separate the stormwater from the sanitary. The last one that's underway right now is the city of Astoria, and I think that will take through the rest of this decade for them to complete that process. But all the others have completed where there was a combined sanitary stormwater system before.
And Senator, the ratepayers in Portland, $1.4 billion.
I remember it was $1 billion.
We're still
project.
Paying it off. We will for a long time.
Yeah. Follow-up question. One of the concerns I've heard about this since that time is that we're meeting the regulations from the federal government. Now the regulations are going to be changed again, potentially, especially for water temperature and turbidity. Do you have any comment about that? Do you know anything about it? I've heard discussions about it. For instance, in Medford, we're concerned that we discharge into the Rogue River from the city of Medford. The water's clean that goes in, but the temperature is different. We're worried about temperature changes in the river because of it. And some of the smaller cities like Gold Hill are having real problems. They can't meet the requirements, and they're concerned about how they're going to deal with this.
So, Chair Dingefelder, Senator Bates, so in fact, these are not federal requirements. Maybe I should back up. So water quality standards are set at the state level and then approved by EPA. So unlike air, where a lot of the major ambient air quality standards are set at the national level, most water standards are set at the state level. So we work and develop them, often with guidance from EPA and obviously with our regulated community, the public, stakeholders, and like that. What you're referring to, turbidity and temperature, are two things underway, I should say, in various stages of being underway. Turbidity is ongoing rulemaking that we're conducting at DEQ, and it's been a standard that we've been trying to find a successful solution for a number of years. So that is something we're working on. The other one is temperature, and that is subject to a litigation that's now going on between Northwest Environmental Advocates and U.S. EPA and NOAA and U.S. Fish and Wildlife, of which we're an intervener in the lawsuit. What is at stake there is what are the biologically based numbers, which means is it 68 degrees, 66 degrees for salmon, or 20 degrees or 22. And then also other parts of the temperature standard, like we have a provision in there that's being that the judge is basically saying shouldn't be there, is the natural conditions criteria. And what that is an opportunity to acknowledge that in cases, in many situations in Oregon, the natural condition of the water would be warmer at certain times of the year than a biologically based number. And it's our ability to acknowledge that and work with both the point source and non-point source, acknowledging that instead of having a maximum temperature of, say, 20 degrees, realize it may have to be 22 or 24 if you took all of man's influence away You still couldn't get down to 20. And that is subject to litigation, and we still don't know when that will, how that will play out. Likelihood there will be temperature rulemaking in the future as a result of that litigation.
Thank you.
Very simple.
Very simple.
Straightforward.
Okay, very straightforward. All right.
Sorry about
Any
that.
Other questions for these gentlemen? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Sue Marshall and Travis Williams from Willamette Riverkeeper up next. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name's Sue Marshall. I'm here today with Travis Williams representing Willamette Riverkeeper. I'd like to thank you very much for hearing this bill. Just for starters, I'd like to explain the proposed amendment language, and then I'll turn it over to Travis to talk in more detail about the incident that inspired this to come back before you. We really intended the bill to be a place saver. It's not our desire to address mixing zones, but to provide the public with accessible information by simply requiring a sign for the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permit holders, those NPDES permits that are issued by DEQ. A sign that could be posted near the outfall for discharges to public waters that are used by the public for water contact recreation. The language is modeled after New York State. Both New York and Tennessee require signs at NPDES discharge outfalls. It excludes stormwater discharge outfalls, requires certain information to be listed on the sign, the permit number, telephone number, a website linking to DEQ, and the name and number of the permit holder. For those instances when things go wrong, the public would have an easy ability to know who to call. The amendment, as we're suggesting, requires reasonable maintenance of the sign, requires DEQ to post on their website the discharge monitoring reports for the NPDES permit holders. It allows for DEQ to waive all or part of the requirements, for example, if the discharge is temporary, if it's a minor discharge, if there is difficulty locating a sign where it could be visible to the public. We think that it's reasonable for the public to expect to readily be able to know what is coming into the public waters where they may be having physical contact with through swimming or boating. I guess with that, I'll turn it over to Travis.
Thanks, Sue. Once again, my name is Travis Williams. I'm Riverkeeper and Executive Director for Willamette Riverkeeper. And so just to highlight again, this is not a buoy bill. No buoys involved. This is an effort to sign, as Sue said, public outfalls. And if there is an issue that someone thinks they've discovered, they have a very clear opportunity to look at the permit holder, have a phone number, and talk to them directly. Now, why does this matter? Well, okay. So there's a photo of my daughters paddling, as hundreds of people do on the Willamette River every year. People camp along the river. People fish, both power boats, fly fishing in different areas. This river really does get used. And as you know, there are multiple discharge points along the Willamette. Here's a scene enjoying a Willamette Greenway, which happens to be about a mile downstream from an issue we had last summer when I was taking a group of folks out and back ferrying across the river in a canoe, chit-chatting about what we were seeing, and suddenly the river on my right went black, or near enough so to call it that, and the river on the left was green. And in this image, you get a sense of that in the background. The water is very dark colored and it's green. Now, as we continue to examine this, we paddled into it, took some photographs. Here in the foreground, you've got that black water and then the green water. And as we began to realize where we were, you know, I've done this job for 13 years, so I had a sense that I was near two mills that had a discharge point here. The point is, the average person wouldn't know that. And in addition to the water being this color, there was a really putrid smell that accompanied it, and it covered a wide area. So you try to imagine yourself paddling the Willamette River, fishing the Willamette River, or any river in Oregon, and you happen to have a site that has a malfunction. As the average person, you sure would wonder what's going on here. And this kind of brought us back to the notion of, gosh, wouldn't signs make sense at MPDS permit discharge points? Doesn't say anyone is doing something wrong, but it gives a contact number, and what we propose is that contact number goes directly to that entity, and they have an opportunity to speak with members of the public. They can tell them what's going on, if it seems that everything's okay under the permit. The other piece of this is that the public has an opportunity, if there is something going wrong, given that many of these permit holders don't get down to these sites all that often to really check them out, the public has an opportunity to inform the permit holder, hey, there's an issue here, you guys need to deal with it. In my view, that makes a lot of sense. And having had this experience last summer, we did a flyover about 2 weeks later. This particular plume, and I see the folks are in the room here today, they have a plan to address this, but just to give you a sense of this, this extended downstream a half a mile, maybe a little less than that initially, and then it resurfaced all the way with that smell. And as we investigated this, we found out that those fishing and other paddlers had called Oregon Parks and Recreation Department to try to figure out if they knew anything. Again, you're passing many Oregon State Parks greenway sites along the Willamette. Might be a natural place to call. There were also local inquiries by a fishing guide and some other people that fish for smallmouth bass in the area. So the point here is not to bring up something that's punitive to a particular industry or to municipalities. It's to say, hey, under the Clean Water Act, we discharge at this point. We run a tight ship. Everything should be okay. If you have a question about it, here's our phone number. Easy. Signage is inexpensive, easy to replace should it get damaged, easy to monitor. I think that's the last picture there. So in our view, you know, given that there is precedent for this, it makes a lot of sense to go this direction. I guess I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Travis. Let's see if there's any questions as we put the lights up. Any questions? It's not often folks are speechless up here.
What was actually going on? What kind of mill was it?
Had
a malfunction in the mill? Was it a temporary thing?
Thank you, Senator, for the question. This is Cascade Pacific Pulp, and their mixing zone was, in essence, malfunctioning. And it was expanding over an area that was far too large.
I assume they're unaware of that, or they would have fixed it sooner.
They were aware of it, and they were working on a fix.
Okay.
And they continue to do that, and they will do work this coming summer.
Follow-up. And did the company know that and was working on it, or was it as a result of people going on the river telling them we have a problem?
They did know it. It had been a recurring problem.
But they were working on it.
Yes.
Were they out of compliance with their permit?
Yes.
Well, you're the other side of the story, probably. Okay.
Yeah, we don't have anybody signed up, but I'm sure I will be asking if anyone wants to come up.
Senator Hansel,
yeah.
Is your proposal that I think we heard previously there are 300 mixing zone permits throughout the United States? Are you proposing we put a sign up on every one of them? I'm not United States, Oregon, I'm sorry.
Yes. It really has less to do with mixing zones and more to do with discharge points under the Clean Water Act.
Fine.
Do
you have a price tag for how much those cost? And then secondly, who do you propose will maintain them? And how far up on the bank do you need to go? Flood waters, wash them out? I'm just curious as to maintenance, costs involved. Have you thought through that yet, Travis?
In in the signage that we at Willamette Riverkeeper have made over the years or contributed to, I think you're looking at a few hundred dollars if you want to have a sign that looks a certain way. We haven't stipulated what the sign should look like. So the sign could be a very basic, almost homespun conveyance of information. And I know the signs that we put up, you know, you buy a 4x4 that's 8 feet high for $20. You slap the sign on that. You plant it in the ground with some concrete.
So, Travis, I'm just going to do a follow-up to Senator Hansel's question. I think I heard you say this is required in New York State. Is that correct?
Yes.
So our staff is looking to see if there's something in statute or if that was done through rule and how that's administered. We'll see if we can get that information. I'm assuming you don't know. When you research this, do you know if there's anything in statute that stipulated how this was displayed or not? But we can find that out. I think that's
yeah, they call for a green background and white lettering. There are some dimensions. I think it's 18 by 24.
Yeah.
I'd have to look through it. But yeah, so they're sizable so you can see it from the water as you pass by.
Okay. So we'll get that information.
Yeah. And I don't know what Tennessee does on that front. I do know that their Department of Environmental Quality made this decision on their own and started requiring signage at all discharge points.
Did you want to add anything, Sue? Okay. Any other questions? Okay. All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you for bringing this to our attention. Okay. We have Tracy Rutter, Mark Yeager, and Mark Chuckers up next. We're going to hear from the municipality perspective.
Meeting their permits. They're trying to point out the public that something's going on and trying to build public support for their side of the collection of levy release. Mm-hmm. What's the real thing?
Okay, welcome. Mark, do you want to start off? Or whoever wants to start off? We just need
chair.
Somebody to start off.
Mr. Joggers.
Oh, okay.
Walked away from the chair, but he's going to start first.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Mark Chalkers. I'm the Government Public Affairs Manager with Clean Water Services in Washington County. I've been working on water resource management issues in the Tualatin Basin for about 20 years now. I'm testifying here on behalf of Clean Water Services as well as the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I want to tell you a little bit about Clean Water Services and then some of the concerns we have with this bill. Clean Water Services is a county service district providing water resource management services to about 530,000 people in Washington County, as well as small portions of Clackamas and Multnomah County. We provide wastewater and stormwater services, manage flow in the Tualatin River, and are working with our partners to coordinate regional integrated water supply planning to meet the long-term water needs of ag, of business, of fish, of water quality, as well as economic development. We're committed to public health and the environment. We have a 40-year history of working with local, regional, and national partners to reach beyond regulatory requirements to deliver value for our ratepayers. Thanks to the community's investment in advanced wastewater treatment in the Tualatin Basin, comprehensive stormwater management, and basin-wide restoration activities, the Tualatin River and its tributaries are healthier today than they've been in generations. Clean Water Services operates 4 wastewater treatment plants in the Tualatin Basin and cleans about 60 million gallons of wastewater a day, before releasing it to the Tualatin River. Now, to get to Senator Olson's question of plumes, what does this look like? Hard for me not to travel. So this is what we release to the Tualatin River, 60 million gallons of this a day. Doesn't look much like a plume. Just for comparison.
Are you going to drink that?
No, I brought it for you. it's my gift.
You live in Washington County, you drink it. Senator Hass.
Senator Hass, perhaps.
Yes.
This is the Tualatin River itself. That's a sample I actually collected the other day. It gives you a sense of what our releases look like in terms of water. Now, some of the concerns we have with this bill, placing signage at these outfalls does nothing to improve water quality, nor does it provide, in my estimation, any useful information to the public. If persistent bioaccumulative toxins and water quality are the concern, our collective focus should really be on those pollution prevention issues that we've talked about and source control, not installing and maintaining signs. We have about 8 outfalls from our 4 wastewater treatment plants. We have multiple outfalls at some of them. Pollution prevention and source control has worked. We've seen a real effort at Clean Water Services success with that. The legislature, 2 examples of bills that the legislature has passed that we've seen results at our treatment plants. In the early 1990s, the legislature passed a phosphate detergent ban. We had very tight phosphorus rules in our water quality permit in the Tualatin Basin. We saw a 22% reduction in the amount of phosphorus coming to us, which saved considerable money in terms of capital costs. That was a source control issue that worked. We really had a problem there. Legislature went after it. That was very helpful. In 2007, the legislature passed a bill requiring dental amalgam separators to control mercury. So I talked to our source control people today. They said that at our 4 treatment plants, we've seen a reduction of about 8 pounds a year of mercury coming into those treatment plants. And that times directly with that with the dental amalgam separators. That's delivering real value there. Under the bill as it's originally written, and I haven't looked at the amendments that closely, DEQ is required to install and maintain all signs in the state. Now, this seems to be a remarkable burden on DEQ at a time when they need to be focusing their efforts on protecting and improving water quality, not doing sign maintenance. Practically, how will DEQ or cities or utilities like Clean Water Services place signs where they can be seen in the summer months and not destroyed by floodwaters in the winter months? The Tualatin River is a rain-fed system, and we... in our role in managing flow in the river, we try to have about 180 cubic feet per second in the summer in the Tualatin River. Now, the winter January average flow is 4,000 cubic feet per second. So it floods the floodplain pretty considerably, and as a result would probably wipe out any sign that might be there. We also have concerns that if these signs become part of our permit, it would increase our liability under the Federal Clean Water Act and the provisions that are there also. Is the sign there? Is the sign not there? Is it being properly maintained? Cities, public agencies, and utilities would also need to secure access to rivers and stream banks from private or public property owners. I'm trying to figure out how we do that. Municipal water quality permit holders operate under very strict DEQ permits, complying with some of the nation's most stringent water quality standards. Clean Water Services facilities are operated by certified operators that are there 24 hours a day and are required to monitor more than 15,000 compliance points annually at our 4 treatment plants. If there's a problem with our outfall, there's a problem with our wastewater treatment plant, we know about it, and we're immediately required to notify DEQ. The last thing I wanted to bring up based on the amendment question that I heard Sue and Travis talk about is this issue of excluding stormwater NPDES outfalls, excluding stormwater outfalls that have exclusively, or NPDES outfalls that have exclusively just stormwater. Our permits allow for things other than stormwater to come in there, such as hydrant flushing, such as irrigation water, things like that. So we don't really have outfalls that are exclusively stormwater. And if you looked at that, I think about in Washington County, we have about 7,500 NPDES outfalls. If you start adding in the stormwater ones. So we'd be very concerned that that language did not include anything on that. So that's, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Why don't we hear from everyone, and then we'll see if there's any questions.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Mark Yeager. I am the Utility Services Manager for the City of Albany. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Clean Water Agencies. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today about this bill. You have written testimony from Oregon Aqua that has been circulated to you. I want to talk a little bit more about the results of Senate Bill 737, primarily because much of what we're talking about today has to do with mixing zones. Yes, the marking part is part of the question that's being raised, but the concerns are what happens if mixing zones aren't functioning properly, et cetera. So in 2010, as a result of the Senate Bill 737 passage, the 52 largest municipalities in Oregon were required to test during two seasons, both the dry season and the wet season, to determine whether or not we had any persistent bioaccumulative toxins in our discharges. We agreed to do that testing voluntarily as part of a collaborative effort with environmental groups, and that was the most expensive or the most extensive testing that's ever been done in the nation. So we had 52 treatment plants. We had 117 different pollutants that were being tested. We did that for two seasons, and we were using extremely low detection levels for monitoring for these pollutants. DEQ selected the parameters. DEQ conducted the testing. They set the threshold levels, and they analyzed the results. So what were the results? The results showed that our treatment techniques and pollution prevention efforts are working to keep persistent pollutants out of municipal effluent. Out of more than 12,000 analyses that were conducted in that 737 testing, we had five results out of 12,000 that exceeded the threshold. So most of the chemicals that were looked for, there were not measurable levels detected. In addition to that 737 testing, which was a one-time testing to try to give us an indication of what's happening with municipal wastewater, we also do routine testing. Treatment plants are required on an annual basis to test for priority pollutants. At a minimum, they have to do it at least once a year. Some of the larger treatment plants are doing it four times a year, like the city of Portland. And then four times prior to an annual renewal or a five-year renewal, we have to do a bioassay testing where we expose sensitive species directly to the wastewater that's being discharged into the river. We feel that we are doing a great job in terms of working hard to keep pollutants out of our waste stream. We don't manufacture anything at wastewater treatment plants. We treat the wastewater that comes to us. Pollution prevention is the most efficient and cost-effective way for us to reduce pollution in Oregon's rivers and streams. Mark talked a little bit about the Dennis program that we have. We were working on that before the legislature passed its law. We applaud the legislature for taking that action and making it required. We have industrial pretreatment programs for certain businesses that discharge to the largest municipal treatment plants. We are supportive and have helped to coordinate the pesticide stewardship program and unused and unwanted pesticide collection programs. We work collaboratively with users to reduce pesticide use and to provide collection programs for proper disposal. We established the Oregon Clean and Safe Program, which is an outreach and education effort through eco-certification of products free of those 117 chemicals that we talked about and that were identified during the Senate Bill 737 process. And we also support and have been instrumental in establishing collection boxes for unwanted and unused medicines. Currently, there are 60 of those across the state in different municipalities. We have one in Albany at the Albany Police Department. So we're not supportive of Senate Bill 523 because we don't think it does anything really to help water quality. Our business is improving water quality in Oregon. Senate Bill 523 provides a sign, which Mark talked just briefly about what some of the difficulties are there with those signs. And we in the municipal sector have very strict requirements in terms of reporting if anything goes wrong. I appreciate and understand the concerns that Travis raised, and those photos are pretty dramatic for the things that were happening on that day. In the municipal treatment plant sector, We have certified operators that run our facilities. We have alarms on if there's any problems with pumps or monitors or any of those sorts of things. And we're required to report, as Mark said, immediately to DEQ if we've got a problem. That process results in public notification. That process results in public access because it makes it into the news when something happens. So we appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you about this today. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Great. Thank you, Mark. Actually, I am going to ask you a couple of quick questions before we go on. And thank you for, you've testified many times in front of the committee, so appreciate you coming back. And it's been a few years since I read the summary report prior to this committee hearing on Senate Bill 737 when we were first working on that and we got the first report. So one of the things that you mentioned that just reminded me that when we crafted that bill, the reporting requirement was only for municipal outfalls. And you were talking about that, you know, the requirements that municipalities mainly through the wastewater treatment plants required. Now, I probably need to bring DEQ back up for this, but do we know what percentage of NPDES permits are separate from wastewater treatment plants? In other words, the reporting is coming from wastewater treatment plants, correct? That's the reports that you're talking about that you worked on collaboratively were all public, were wastewater treatment facilities.
Yes.
Didn't include private facilities, NPDES permitted facilities, correct? Like the one that we saw in the picture.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. I don't know what the numbers of permits are in the state of Oregon, so you might have to ask DEQ that. But Senate Bill 737 only applied to the 52 largest municipal dischargers in the state.
That we don't have, at least through the 737 process, and I'll probably have DEQ come back up, we don't have the monitoring data. This applies to if there was an industrial discharger that through pretreatment went through your system, we would have that data, but separately, we don't have it through the 737 system. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And as far as for pretreatment, if there was any problems, I'm assuming you would deal with that directly with, since they're discharging into your system, so to speak.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, that's true. We coordinate, and the industrial pretreatment program requires industrial dischargers to do separate monitoring, to do reporting. We have, in Albany, we have staff that go around and look at all of those discharges on a daily basis, and so coordinate with the industry. So we're constantly working with those folks.
Okay. And I know we have John Ledger from the Association of Oregon Industries coming up, so I'm sure he'll address that. Thank you for that clarification. I just want to make sure folks understand who Senate Bill 737 applied to and who it did not.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Rutten, and I'm here today with the League of Oregon Cities. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today on this bill. The League of Oregon Cities opposes Senate Bill 523. As you've heard, we have for multiple sessions, going back well over a decade, been put in the position to defend National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits. These permits are essential to our ability to provide service in the safe and cost-effective treatment of public wastewater. And these permits provide specific guidelines to ensure compliance with the Clean Water Act and state water quality standards. And as a side note, I was doing my research, as I'm relatively new at LOC and to this issue, reading my EPA primer for wastewater treatment systems, and noted something interesting in reading that report, which was their reference to NPDES permits as one of the most common pollution control systems that's used in the United States. And I thought that's interesting that they actually are referring to it as a system for pollution control. And that's how we look at it. And as Mark indicated, we're not putting the things into that water. We're trying to take them out. The proponents of this bill have historically made efforts to ban mixing zones, and that would have significant financial impacts to local government and to our ratepayers. There is actually currently a House bill, though I don't know who proposed that bill, that was introduced this session that would essentially make NPDES permits illegal. So this is of high concern to us.
I have some constitutional issues.
I have a bill number if you
buy. I was going to say, I might have some constitutional issues in the Clean Water Act.
We've got a lot of questions about that bill as well.
Rest assured, it's not my bill.
Okay, thank you. I realize that Senate Bill 523 is not an attempt to ban mixing zones, but it appears to us to be a first step to create concern about legal discharges where there is none that exists, in our opinion. We currently treat water to meet these water quality standards, often exceeding the standards, and our cities take pride in that responsibility. This process is a costly one, and our citizens and businesses are highly sensitive to increases in those costs. It's for that reason that we focus on efforts to reduce pollutants that enter into our system, as is a far more cost-effective and efficient way to prevent pollution than to treat it out of the pipe. I have a list of reasons that we oppose the bill, but they really did cover them, so out of respect for your time, I will just say thank you and offer to answer any questions that you have.
Great, thank you. Any questions, Senator Hansel?
Question for Mark. You'd mentioned that the flow summer versus winter was 180 cubic feet summer, 4,000 in winter runoff. Mm-hmm. As far as height of the water from one level to from minimum to maximum, can you give a figure on that? I mean, what are we looking at there?
You know, I asked that question to Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel. I asked that question today of our flow folks. They said it was about 20 feet. Now, we have a very, very flat watershed in the Tualatin Basin, so a 20-foot height spreads out pretty considerably. If you've
follow-up. So basically then to keep the signs from being washed away in your system, they would have to be some 20 plus feet above the minimum, you know, the summer water level in order to survive even a year.
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel. Yes, that or does the sign go at the edge of the 100-year floodplain, which could be hundreds of, you know, it could be 100 yards from the edge of where the stream is, where the actual outfall is.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I had one last question, and again, this may be DEQ, but I'm sort of recalling that we talked about having our NPDES locations available online. Do you know the answer? If not, I'll call DEQ up at the end.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's information on DEQ, on DEQ's website about all of our discharges. There's access when permits are up. You can look at permits, all those sorts of things. I don't know specifically whether or not they have a map, for example, or some sort of an application that you can just click on and say, where are the dischargers in my vicinity? So I don't know that they have that product
there. I think we discussed that back when we were talking about Senate Bill 737, so I'm starting to think that if folks were interested, it's a little harder when you're in your canoe, although I'm sure that we could probably develop an app. But that is, to me, a more practical approach than having signs that can be washed away. But it's just, I'll probably call the department back up. I'm sure that somebody else has thought of this idea because it's not, I'm sure, a novel idea, but I think there's probably ways that we can look at that that might be less onerous as well. Thank you for coming here today. Appreciate hearing
Thank
the update.
You.
It's really important, and you should leave that for Senator Haas since it's from his district and my old river.
We're returning it to you.
Yeah. Yes, in full disclosure, I said to him, you may be drinking part of that, but the drinking water source is up. I know it's up above the outfall.
Yes.
I know exactly where they are, so I'll say that. Next, Jim Myron and Peggy Lynch. And I probably, just DEQ for you to know, I'll call you back up so you can, I know you're taking copious notes so you can answer all these questions. Come back up. Actually, we can call up Emily Auckland, too, because we have three chairs up here. Is Emily here somewhere? Yeah, okay. Whoever wants to get started.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelter and members of the committee.
Yeah, I was like, there's no syllable in between. I know it's late in the day. Yeah. I've been called a lot of things, believe me.
Not by me. Yeah. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society, and we're here in support of this little bill, which seems like a pretty simple bill. It's always easier to find things wrong with something than to find things right. So I think that's what you're hearing today. But if there's, it seems to me that this is kind of a public interest type thing. Shouldn't the public know where these discharge points are, and how hard can it be to figure out the technology of putting a sign next to a river? even if you do it seasonally, there's got to be a way to figure that out. State Parks put signs all the way up and down the Willamette River as to where their properties are located so people can recreate on them. If parks can do signs, we ought to be able to figure this out. So anyway, it seems like a simple bill that will do some public good, so we're supporting it. Thank you.
Thank you. Peggy?
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League, too, supports the amended discussion that you heard about of the bill for two reasons. One is the opportunity for public notice and for education. It provides an opportunity to actually have a conversation how all of us have a responsibility to keep our rivers and streams clean. So this is not, to me, it is not about hitting the municipalities or the businesses on the head with a practice that they are legally allowed to do, but instead it allows us to have this conversation about knowing that we too, through our non-point source pollution, pollute the rivers. And as we educate people on these issues, we can have that broader conversation. So we just see the signage as an educational opportunity and not overly burdensome to municipalities or industries. My neighbors in the Corvallis area have dealt with this issue, have very great concerns about the outfalls from wastewater, but not only that, from the stormwater pipes. So we are working on that discussion locally to how to resolve that kind of an issue. But we see this as an opportunity for public education.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Emily Ackland. I'm the Environmental Policy Manager at the Association of Oregon Counties. AOC opposes Senate Bill 523, and I think I'll be speaking to some of the unintended consequences of how the original bill was drafted. And given the recent Supreme Court case on logging roads, we're sensitive to what's considered a point source. So some counties hold NPDES Phase 2 permits. And most counties, or I should say all counties, will at some point have a 1200C permit for road construction projects. If counties are required to put markers at all their discharge points, that could include ditches, culverts, and the funds for that would just be unobtainable. So again, I think I'm speaking to unintended consequences, and I haven't had time to review the amended version. I think I'll leave it at that. Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for any of these witnesses? All right. Thank you all for testifying. And we have two more people signed up, John Ledger and Tom Wolf. And then is there anybody else? I will call up the DEQ to answer some of these questions at the end, but is there anybody else that would like to testify on the bill? Okay. Why don't you come on up? John, why don't you go first, because you were first signed up.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Good afternoon. John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. I'll just touch on a couple of things. One, I thought we could, something that came up earlier that I think I can address on 737, the bill. Industrial discharges are a little different than municipal discharges, in that municipal discharges collect from a huge array of sources, including commercial operations and industrial operations, and different size and types of populations. So it's a different mix. On an industrial source, often, especially if it's non-contact cooling water, which is common, they'll take in the river water from the river, use it for cooling, which means some evaporates, so the concentration of the pollutants coming in is up. So when it goes back into the river, you have to have a permit because the concentration is up, the mass is the same. Or if there is contact of some type and there are emissions effluent into the water, it's DEQ already knows what's there because it's just coming from that plant. So you're not dealing with this huge array of unknowns. It's very much known, and they test for that. As far as a map goes, I just happened to Google a couple of things, just looking on the list that I gave you of dischargers, because I wanted to know what they were and where they were, and up popped maps, quite a few, actually, where you can actually look and see where the discharges are.
Our staff is looking right now.
And you should have now a list that I handed out of all the discharge permits.
And this includes municipal, correct?
It includes everything, top to bottom. Wanted to touch on a couple of things. So there are two state agencies that deal with this already. Of course, one is the EQC, that if they felt there was a health issue, they would certainly have looked at it. They've been looking at water quality standards for a long time. We probably have the most stringent water quality standards in the nation, so we're going to have a lot of mixing zones. We're going to have very, very strict permit requirements. The other is where this has occurred, for instance, the Columbia Slough, where there was an advisory for fish consumption, the Oregon Health Authority did put out signage. So there are agencies that can deal with this now and, in fact, have dealt with it already. I don't think you need to have signs everywhere. The signs. I don't know anyone who thinks they won't be vandalized or removed. One of the problems is the sign requirement becomes part of the permit, which means it is federally enforceable and liable for third-party lawsuits. And in it, in the one of the bills, anyway, one of the versions I saw, that you have to show as a defense that you have good faith documented effort to maintain the sign, which means you're going to have an inspection routine and documentation and record keeping about the sign. This is going to, we believe, require the DEQ to do some considerable rulemaking. There are provisions in the amendments and in the bill dealing with what reasonably maintained means. Is it inconsistent with other statutes? What constitutes a public purpose? For instance, if the sign doesn't meet it, all that's going to have to be spelled out in rule. It talks about a temporary discharge, does not say what that is. That will be a rule item. What is a significant discharge, at least in the original bill? That will have to be a rule item. Then for each permit, the DEQ must establish, in each case, the actual appearance of the sign, the actual location of the sign, and determine the proximity of discharge while ensuring maximum visibility from both the shore and surface water for the sign. This is going to take agency resources. It's going to take resources everywhere. There are lots of dischargers, as you can see from the list. And looking at one of the amendments, there was actually some verbiage in there about the sign. And so I thought, well, what would the sign look like? How big would the sign be? And I want you to look at that list you have, and this is the size of the sign. So you're going to have these festooning our waterways, and I'm not sure for exactly what purpose. But there are mechanisms to deal with these issues. The health authority can, the DEQ can if there's a problem, and we don't see this as really helping. I think where there are problems, as you heard from Mr. Williams, where he came across one and he did the right thing. He reported it, and it's getting resolved. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sullivan?
For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director in Oregon for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, commonly known as AWPPW. In the spirit of this, we're opposed to it. We find it as an employment issue for us. I want to thank this committee for their vote on Senate Joint Memorial 5, which points to the huge subsidies the Chinese government has given the Chinese pulp and paper industry. But what needs to be told, too, is the environmental concerns. You know, they have coal-generating electrical plants coming on monthly in China. Quite frankly, as industrial workers in this country and in the state, kind of feel like redcoats during the Revolutionary War, where everybody in the world seems to be shooting at us from different angles, and we have to march in columns. So I don't think in Oregon we can afford to lose one job. Thank you. I'll answer any questions.
You get the last word, Tom.
Can I savor that just a moment? All right, I'm done. For the record, Chair Dingfelder, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm speaking for the 3,000 members of Trout Unlimited here in the state, and we are a unique organization. We're a conservation group full of fishermen, and our members use many parts of the waterways here in the state, whether it's fishing for spring Chinook in the lower Willamette, steelhead in the Clackamas, Sandy, or many other rivers such as the Sanium, smallmouth bass, and I won't mention that very loudly since we're a wild fish, trout, and salmon group in parts of the Willamette.
My vice chair will like that.
He probably eats them.
Yeah, I do eat those. Yeah. But going on, and also for the unique population of wild cutthroat in the upper part of the Willamette, which are a special place for me to fish every year. We support SB 523. We believe that this is a very simple bill that requires signage that gives people when they're out in the river and they see problems like this somebody to call, somebody to talk to. And we also think it would benefit the owners that might not be aware that there's a problem that exists, and this would be give people a chance to contact and let them know. And I have nothing but respect for the industry. I've sat on the advisory committee for Clean Water Services for 7.5 years. They liked me so much they extended my term for 1.5 years. Well, I'm not sure if they liked me that much or they were desperate. But I think what they've done in reaction to Senate Bill 737 is amazing. I have nothing but praise for the industry, nothing but appreciation for people like Mark Jockers and other people of his group. But I think this is a simple bill that would require simple signs that could warn people to allow them to call somebody and report problems that happen on the river. I don't think it would be tremendously expensive. I think that it would be simple, and I think that it should be allowed to be passed. Thank you.
Thank you. And any questions for any of these panelists? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And before we adjourn the public hearing, I'll ask DEQ to come back up. And if you want to speak to some of the questions that were raised, that would be helpful. Thank you, Greg.
Again, Greg Aldridge, Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Senator Dingfelder, a couple of questions. Hopefully I've gotten them all. Question was about how many permits. So I'll start with the majors. Majors are those that discharge 1 million gallons per day of wastewater or serve roughly a community of about 10,000 people. There are 69 major permitted facilities in the state right now. 50 of them represent the municipalities for their POTWs or publicly operated treatment works, and 19 of them are major industrial sources. And of that subset of industrial sources, about 10 of them represent pulp and paper or fiber facilities. And I pull them out because they're one of the bigger sectors in the industrial part for the state of Oregon. So as you can see, the primary part is for the municipalities. So one of the questions was, well, 737 was geared towards the municipalities, and it was, but I don't want people to think that industrial sources are off the hook. True, they were not part of the 737 process, but just like the municipalities, they have monthly discharge monitoring reports that need to be submitted to DEQ. They have, depending on their size and their permit requirements, quarterly or yearly special monitoring and additional monitoring requirements at the time of permit renewals, and permits are typically 5 years. So there is a lot of monitoring and watching of what the industrial community is doing as well as for the municipal community. There's a breakdown I have for major versus for majors. Roughly, there are another probably 270 minor permits, and then there are a bunch of what we call general permits. They're lumped together. Food and beverage processing are common minor industrial sources in the state. So if you want to think of who might be in that one, there is an example of that. The other, when you start getting into industrial, actually, it affects even municipalities because it often is filtered backwash operations, seafood processing operations, something like that. Ones that tend to be fairly small and very similar from one facility to another, so one permit can take care of all the needs for regulatory requirements. The other question, and I think John Ledger may have answered it, is about mapping of discharge points. So all the permits should be online for everyone who is permitted by DEQ, and then there should be a mapping function out there for them. I know we are having problems with technology trying to catch up with that, but if it's not there through a simple mapping feature like John had mentioned, it's also there in the permit that's online. So I think those are the major questions.
Thank you, Greg. So, yeah, the committee staff is sending that link out to all okay. of the committee members. But I just want to be clear for people listening. So if somebody wanted to see where the NPDES permits are in their vicinity, they can get on your website and click on a map and find out how many permits were there and who owns and operates them.
Correct. So they would need to go into the DEQ website and the state website system and then go into the water quality program and look under wastewater permitting. And you should find that information. If not, they can contact me.
We'll make sure that we get that information out to all the committee members so they have that. Senator okay. Bates, did you have a question?
Yeah, just a clarification. I'm sorry I had to step out. And I've read the bill, and I want to make sure I understand the bill. And there may be amendments, but I haven't seen it change it. But the original bill references that signage is going to be for those mixing zones where bioaccumulative toxins are going beyond what the permit is for. Is that correct? If you're discharging above and beyond what you're supposed to be discharging, am I reading that correctly? It references an ORS that I haven't looked up yet, 468B.050. The question I'm leading to, are we talking about signage for every single mixing zone, or just those mixing zones like the one we saw today where there's a problem, they're outside of their permit, you mark that, and when they get back inside the permit, you can pull the signage down. What are we really talking about here in this bill?
Well, Chair Dingfelder and Senator Bates, we're not the author of the bill,
yeah,
so
you
I can't really
have to ask the
intent of it. Maybe others could be able to do that. I could try to answer other questions, but it's not our bill, and it wasn't our intent.
I can have Travis. Travis, why don't you come back up real quickly to answer the question. That's okay. You can stay there in case there's other questions from the department.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates.
Can you just state your name again?
Travis Williams, Executive Director and Riverkeeper for Willamette Riverkeeper. The intent is to have everybody who has an NPDES permit that discharges wastewater into state's waters. So it's really not about mixing zones in and of themselves. If you have a wastewater permit and you're discharging, there should be a sign from our perspective that says who you are, permit number, contact info, should an issue arise. And I would also speak briefly to a point that Jim Myron made. There are signs along rivers in many, many, many places. It's not rocket science. They stay there through floods even. I've noticed this on the Willamette. Occasionally they're vandalized, and occasionally they do go away with extreme events. I just want to reiterate that point.
Does that answer your question, Senator?
Yeah, I don't think that's what the bill says, but maybe it does.
I'm referring to the amended language.
Amendment, okay.
Yes. So in some ways, you could, that original bill was sort of a placeholder. If you read the amendment, it's very clear about what we're asking.
Okay, thank you. I mean, we've seen this bill before back in 2001.
And just for the record, it is online in OLIS and in your packet, so you should have received it.
Well, it's probably here, and I just can't find it. It's me, not the
commission. It should be on the dais
as well.
Good
to find the original bill. Do you have
a question, or you want to
say
something?
Break here. Thank you.
Yeah. Hold on before you. Yes.
I just want to say I appreciate the efforts that Travis has put out on behalf of that river for the last 13 years. I think, except for the times when you have to come up here, you probably have the best job in the world. You're new all day, and we do appreciate your service on that river.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hansel, did you have any further questions? Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. Thanks for coming back up, gentlemen. Anybody else that want to testify before we close the public hearing on this? Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 523. Beth, anything else for the good of the order?
I think that's everything.
Okay, great. With that, we are adjourned.